The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's Civics 101, Word of Mouth series and podcast refresher course on how American democracy was designed and how it is practiced in the real world. Today, we tackle a question that came to us through our website, civics101podcast.org. What does it mean when we say a president has the nuclear codes? What is a sitting president authorized to do in the case of a nuclear strike? Well, our guide to answer that question is retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel James Wyrick. He's host of the podcast Military Justice. James, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the first part of the question. What does it mean when we say the president has the nuclear codes?
Well, the president has both the codes and the authority to launch a nuclear strike. He carries with him or her what's known as the biscuit, that is about the size of a credit card encased in another opaque credit card that you would have to snap off the outside layer to look at the inside. And that has what they call the gold codes. And that allows the president to communicate with the military and ensure that that is actually the president giving that order. The bag or briefcase that is carried by the military aide that follows the president around is called the football. And so the little case that the president, I think most presidents keep them in their jacket. There was a story that they thought President Reagan carried his in his sock because after the assassination attempt, you know, as he was rushed off to the hospital, everything was taken off and somebody had slipped it into his sock, but he actually carried it in his jacket pocket.
Okay, biscuit just sounds like such an innocuous little thing for something that is potentially assuring mutual destruction.
Yeah, but biscuits and football, it sounds like some sort of British Sunday afternoon that they're going to go watch football and have a biscuit, right?
I know, and it's a pretty serious stuff. But tell me about the football also. So somebody is always walking around with the president carrying the, quote, football?
There's usually either a lieutenant colonel or a commander, so a senior mid-level officer of the military. There's one from each of the services, and that person carries a Halliburton briefcase, one of those hardened aluminum briefcase, and they are always within pretty much the arm's distance with the president. And inside there's a satellite phone, there's various plans and various nuclear strike options that the president could initiate.
So only one person, I mean, just at any given time, one person can set off a nuclear strike?
No, we do have the two-person rule. Also, the Secretary of Defense would have to ensure that that order is coming from the president and that it is an order coming from the president. This all comes into at least our modern way of doing this. Comes into being after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there was some question about whether or not the actual launch order was coming from the president. So now we're really just concerned about the identity of the person who is saying launch.
All right, so walk us through the steps. Let's say the president says, you know, gets word that there's been a nuclear strike and it's time to retaliate, pulls out the biscuit / credit card, puts in the code. The Secretary of Defense does the same thing. What happens next? Where does it go? And how many warheads are suddenly at his disposal?
Well, so you have, if you had an ICBM launch, an intercontinental ballistic missile from, let's say, Russia or China, you have about 30 minutes before that strike hits in the United States. If we're talking about a Russian sub off the East Coast, you're down to about 10 to 15 minutes. So the president would break open his gold codes, the little credit card, and then he would be in contact with the military command office. And the military command office would issue a challenge code, you know, the like knock, knock, and then he says who's there, you know, and they're, I believe they're usually two-letter challenge, you know, so A, B, and then he responds C, D. And then the same thing happens with the Secretary of Defense. And then there's three options inside the football. It has a light, medium, and heavy package that the president could then order. And that just means the number of warheads, the number of targets, and how we would respond to that first launch from an enemy.
Wow. Okay, so that is in the case of a retaliatory strike. But could a president order a nuclear strike without a precipitating event?
A president definitely could. It would not be as time-sensitive, or it should not be as time-sensitive, in that there would be time for the National Security Council to meet and deliberate and at least give advice to the president. But in the end, you know, under the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, the president is the commander-in-chief. So his orders go from the president to the Secretary of Defense to the regional combatant commanders. That's really all it takes. Nobody has any veto power there.
This is Civics 101. It's Word of Mouth's ongoing series about how our government functions. And today we're talking about the nuclear codes with retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel James Weirich. James, have any presidents come close to using the biscuit?
There was a close call during the Carter administration. In the middle of the country, we have bases that monitor this. They received a message that there had been a very large strike by the Soviet Union. And it turns out that that was wrong. That was communicated to the Secretary of Defense. And it seems that we're about 3 minutes from telling the president at the time that happened. But everyone figured out, oh, wait, we were running a drill. The Soviets didn't really launch any missiles. Let's not wake up the president. So I believe that's the closest we've come post Cuban Missile Crisis.
But so the potential for human error is huge here. And I'm even thinking, like, the biscuit. I mean, people have misplaced their wallets, something like as small as a credit card. Have there ever been any kind of mishaps with the biscuit itself?
Well, I mentioned with President Reagan when he was shot. And then it seems from my reading that most every president has been separated from it at one time or another. But no one else would be able to pick the biscuit up and use it. It would only be the president that would know which of the codes in line was the right one to read. So you couldn't have somebody else pick it up and then say, oh, hi, I'm the president. Let's launch some missiles.
So we know the protocols, or I guess we do. But how about a potential president? I mean, President Trump has shown himself to be rather thin-skinned and somewhat reactive in his responses. Does he get trained for this? Is there a sort of protocol before handing the biscuit from one president to the next?
I mean, he would receive training on it, but in the end, the office that is the president has that authority. And we had a case during the Nixon administration. There was an Air Force Major Herring, and he was responsible for launching siloed nuclear missiles. And he said, you know, how can I know that the order he receives to launch his missiles came from a sane president? He was questioning that. And then Major Herring was then asked to leave the Air Force. That isn't really a question for the military. The propriety of the order isn't really up for debate. It's just the authenticity of the order.
So this really is something, I mean, for most of American Cold War history, or let's say nuclear missile history, nuclear arms have been used mostly as a deterrent, right? But now you have the possibility of one man, really two men, making the decision to pretty much put an end to life as we know it, if we know the strength of a nuclear bomb. Should we feel assured by this?
I think that we can feel as assured as we have over the past 60 years. I mean, it may go back and forth a bit, but that power has always been there. And I think it's up to the individual listener to determine what they think about the current administration, but I can only underline that that is why it is so important, the person that we pick to be our commander-in-chief.
James Wyrick, a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel and host of the podcast Military Justice. James, thank you for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This episode of Civics 101 was produced by Maureen McMurray. If there's a topic you'd like us to cover, you can submit your question through our website, civics101podcast.org, or you can email it to us in text or a voice message to civics101 at nhpr.org. Who knows, it may inspire a new episode. And we are so happy to tell you that we reached a Civics 101 milestone, 1 million downloads. That means people all across the country and all across the world are learning a little bit more about how this democracy operates from a little local podcast from your local state. And so we really thank you for your support of New Hampshire Public Radio, because your support nurtures some bold ideas that are actually making a difference. So thank you very much.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for our Overheard segment, the occasional series when we share things that we, who work in radio, are listening to. And with us today, we're so glad to have Peter Biello. He's host of All Things Considered here at New Hampshire Public Radio and also of The Bookshelf. Peter, we hear you on tape every week, but nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Virginia.
And also Logan Shannon. She is a producer for our creative unit, which produces Word of Mouth and Outside In, and I might add the progenitor of the Civics 101 series. Hello, Logan.
Hi. I don't think I've ever been referred to as a progenitor.
Well, you know, this is a special day.
I feel kind of excited.
So do you want to keep riding on that zeal and introduce your segment?
Absolutely. So this past weekend, This American Life aired an episode that actually premiered back in 2008. I did not hear it in 2008. This was the first time for me, but it was really fascinating. It was called Switched at Birth. And I'm going to read the sort of description that they have at the website, because it's a complicated story, but I think if I read this description, it'll kind of clear it up. So on a summer day in 1951, two baby girls were born in a hospital in a small town in Wisconsin. The infants were accidentally switched and went home with the wrong families.
Oh my gosh.
One of the mothers realized the mistake but chose to keep quiet until the day more than 40 years later when she decided to tell both daughters what happened. And it, so you hear this like right at the beginning. It's like there's no secret that they were switched at birth, but it's sort of the aftermath of that. So this clip that I want to play comes near the end of this episode, and it's the producer, Jake Halpern. He's talking to Mary Miller, and Mary Miller is the one who knew all along in her heart of hearts that this had happened. And he's talking to Mary Miller about it and how she dealt with keeping the secret and a little bit about why she kept it for so long. So this clip I felt was like really, I definitely had a what moment when I heard this.
Because Mrs. Miller didn't want to cross her husband, all she could do was hope that maybe, if she dropped enough hints, calling the girls sisters and such, Kay would eventually realize on her own what had happened. It was an odd strategy, if you can even call it that. When Sue got married, for instance, the Millers gave her a trivet Norbert had made. The card was signed, "From Your Other Possible Parents." Sue dismissed it as part of the whole sister thing, which she also thought was kind of weird. Mrs. Miller's most ambitious scheme happened after the girls graduated from high school, when they were about to be 18. Mrs. Miller arranged for the McDonald's to come to dinner. She figured if she could simply get Kay to look at Marty, Kay would figure things out. The evening just ended up being kind of baffling for everyone involved, since only Mrs. Miller knew what was going on.
But they didn't notice any. I don't know why they didn't notice it, that Martha looked like them and was like them. I don't know why they didn't notice it.
The fact is, Mrs. Miller longed for Sue, for her biological daughter, ever since she realized the mistake back in 1951. But it seemed futile trying to convince her husband, Norbert.
I think it's not right to do that, you know, to keep somebody else's baby. I didn't think it was right to do that. And every time I'd talk to him, he'd say, it's all right. It'll be all right.
So,
oh my goodness.
Wow.
The whole episode really hit me so hard for a variety of reasons, not the least of which that, like, here's the situation in which your babies are switched and you know, and you can't.
And you know each other. They know the other family.
Yes, they know each other. They live in the same town. They knew the other family. They have this relationship. But she says at some point in this, like, she's like, I knew it would ruin my friendship with my husband because he desperately didn't want her to tell anyone. He didn't want to make waves. He didn't want to upset the doctor, you know, because it was obviously a mistake at the hospital, and he didn't want to make waves. And the whole episode, like, that part of it is, like, actually really shocking. But then from a scientific standpoint, you really get this sense from this episode, it really changes your perspective about nature versus nurture.
Mm-hmm.
Because how these girls were, you know, they're raised in these opposite houses, and they are, like, black sheep's not the right word, but they are not meant to be in the families that they're in. And it's obvious, like, when you talk to them, their personalities work much better with their actual families that they've been separated from 40 years. It's crazy. It's such a crazy story.
Had you ever heard this before, Peter? Because I've heard about this episode.
I had. This weekend was also the first time I had heard this episode, too. And I had the same thought that Logan had about nature versus nurture and wondering, you know, if I had been brought up in a completely different family, would I have ended up in the exact way or similar to the way that I have ended up now? It was an interesting question.
It is such an interesting. And it's also about secrets. Like, the weight of that secret for so many years and having, you know, trying to tell your husband and him sort of dismissing it.
Well, or signing a card for a woman, you know, for this young woman and saying your other possible parents. Like, what? It's crazy. I mean, to live with that.
You would seem like a lunatic if you wrote that kind of letter. Unless you had some kind of sense that something was really, truly wrong.
And then to find out later, like, oh, that's what the letter meant. That's what she meant.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, just one question. Did they get into, like, the daughters and how they felt about it?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's amazing. It's an amazing piece of storytelling for sure.
That is great. We'll have a link to all of our audio selections for today, including that story from This American Life. Peter, what have you got for us?
I've got a long stretch of sounds of crickets that I recorded outside, and there's a reason I recorded it outside, but let's listen to it for a bit. So this was recorded in West Yarmouth, Massachusetts, in this little sort of community of rental homes. And this is kind of a sentimental piece of tape for me because this is a place that, more than any other place on the planet, that I'm able to sort of relax. So, I mean, this segment overheard is about things that public radio people listen to. So this is what I listen to on loop on my headphones at certain times of the day when I just want to decompress from everything that I'm hearing or everything that I'm doing on my job. So sometimes that's what I'm listening to.
So it's sort of like the Swedish television channel that just has the Yule log.
Yes, it's like the audio equivalent of that. Well, the story goes back to, I mean, this little neighborhood, beginning when I was 4 years old, my mother and my aunt would sort of rent a little cabin or cottage somewhere in this neighborhood of about 70 homes or so. And we were always renting the one that was sort of around the cheapest, right? And this was late 80s and then through the 90s. And the prices changed every summer, so we would bounce from house to house. But there was one house that was just, it was on the corner right across the street from the beach. And it was this little rundown thing, like the lawn was just choked with these beech rose bushes and beech grass. And the fence was falling apart, and there was no grass in the backyard. It was sort of like all dead, and every other house in the neighborhood had nice, clean grass. but it was not very expensive. So, and my brother and my mother and my aunt, we would go, and we would just have a great week. One week a summer, every summer when I was growing up. So went to college. My mother passed away when I was 19. We sort of stopped going for a while. I moved away from New England, but when I came back to New England and had a girlfriend and was starting a sort of miniature family of my own, I said, well, why don't we try and rent a house here? And that house where this was recorded was still available, so we rented it and we stayed in it. And it had been 20 years since the last time we stayed in this house, and nothing was changed really. The same crappy furniture and the terrible green tiles on the floor and the wood paneled walls, and one of the walls was all scuffed up where the rocking chair used to sort of bang against it for years and years and years. On the wall at this place is a sort of artist's rendition of the neighborhood from the sky. And if you look closely at that picture, on the ground, underneath that house is the words, the shrine.
Really?
And I didn't know what that meant. So one day we were just lounging at the house, and one of the property managers, who had a long history with this resort, came by. She was looking for an iPhone cord that I guess a previous tenant had forgotten, and they were trying to track it down. Anyway, so while she was there, I said, so what does this mean, the shrine? And this woman sort of went, oh. And then she told me this story of how she had fallen in love with this man who became her husband in that house. And that man happened to be the developer of the entire neighborhood. So, you know, they got married and he eventually died, but she stayed on as the property manager. So she was still involved in that neighborhood, but they had fallen in love in that house and they had special memories in that house. And apparently they had told the whoever drew that picture that, that it was just a special place. So he put the shrine under there. And so while she was there telling me the story, she also said, but, you know, the owners are getting ready to sort of knock this down and build a new one.
Oh.
And, you know, that was the trend in that neighborhood, right? As it is with any good piece of land you have, right? Like the land is almost worth more than the house built on it. And if you build a bigger house.
Right, especially on the Cape.
Especially on the Cape, you know. So they said, you know, we're going to knock this house down. They're going to build something new. And she was sad about it, too, but there was nothing she could do. Because, you know, it's not her house. So so I went into preservation mode. I'm like, I want to preserve what it's like to be in this house. And so I recorded this 10 minutes, as much as my iPhone would allow me to, of what it's like to just be in this neighborhood at night. Now, interesting thing about the neighborhood at night is that there's no traffic, and there are no streetlights here either. So at night, it's just pitch dark, except for like the lights from the houses. So listen to this and just picture a neighborhood where all you see are, you know, living rooms lit up and then families on the inside playing board games or talking, or at least that's what I remember from my childhood. So when I play this at work, I'm taken away from all the crazy news that I hear in the newscast, and I'm there again.
That is how Peter Biello unhooks from the news for Overheard. Beautiful. A beautiful story. I think that's a short story.
Oh, I've written it, but in fiction form somewhere, but I don't know if it has a home yet.
It will find a home like the shrine. Thank you so much. And my story is about something else that's disappeared in some kind of way. Well, I'll give you a hint. It's Richard Simmons.
Here we go!
Yeah, that Richard Simmons.
Toss way back. Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know the guy. Short shorts, bedazzled tank tops, a big curly head of hair halfway between Jimi Hendrix and Little Orphan Annie.
That's the filmmaker Dan Taberski, and he is investigating the mysterious and very sudden disappearance of Richard Simmons, the sort of exercise and guru from, I don't know, 80s, 90s is probably his height. He is a guy who, you know, when the tour buses would go by his house in Hollywood, he'd go out and greet people. And he showed up every day to teach this exercise class at a place called Slimmins, his class, you know, and developed all these fans. Absolutely outwardly kind of exuberant. But then on the 15th of February in 2014, just disappeared.
In February 2014, Richard Simmons ghosted the world.
All of a sudden, nothing.
He wasn't talking to anyone. He wasn't talking to his staff.
He straight up got up and disappeared.
I'm not trying to just blow smoke. He saved a lot of people's lives.
I live a very recluse life.
I know you
do.
This
is about the most, you know...
Hanging out you've done.
Yeah, like four people in a room.
That's...
I teach my class, I kiss everybody, I take hundreds of photos, and I go home.
You do. And
I socialize with no one.
So far, this filmmaker is exploring these theories on, like, what happened? Did the guy just have a breakdown? You know, one of his favorite dogs disappeared. But people who were really close to him, you know, would see him. He'd pick up this 90-year-old woman every single day for exercise class. You know, people that he had phone relationships with for years, you know, the 200 or 300 pound person who's by themselves in Iowa, he would encourage them to get healthy and lose weight, just completely disappeared. And it's a podcast. It's on part two has just recently been released. So it's a kind of serialized podcast.
And what's it called again?
It's called Missing Richard Simmons.
It's so funny because I think about him every once in a while because he was sort of a fixture of my childhood, like watching him on TV, and he'd always be on all the talk shows. And he sort of falls in and out of my consciousness, I think, and he'll show up sometimes. But it's so funny. This podcast came out. I was like, oh, my gosh, I haven't seen Richard Simmons in so long.
That's one of the things I was thinking about. And so this Dan Taberski, you know, he actually goes to the house. All of a sudden, there's a big fence, 6-foot fence around the house where there hadn't been before. There's no doorbell on the fence, you know, on the gate. There's no way to summon anybody inside of the house. And it's just a kind of mystery. And a lot of people are like, well, he just dropped me all of a sudden. And I'm so hurt and sad about it. But then in the second episode, the podcast producer, Dan Taberski, talks to this kind of drag queen from RuPaul's Drag Race, actually, former contender named Willem Belli, who pretty much says, it's not his job to take care of us.
He might have been done, and he doesn't owe to anybody. He pulled back that curtain a little bit and gave people that personal interaction, and now they feel a loss. And you're like, well, why don't you want to be my friend and teach my class? And we had a great relationship. Sorry, girl. Bye. That's what he did. He did a bye, girl, bye. Bye.
What about all the people who, it wasn't just friendship, it was helping people. It was, I live in Iowa, and I weigh 800 pounds, and Richard calls me every week to, you know, to get me to try to think about losing weight. What about those people? He reached out to them. Is there a responsibility there?
Well, that letter that he got, he didn't have to answer it. It was out of the goodness of his heart that he did answer it. So if they got one answer once, they should be happy. They shouldn't be bitching now that they're not getting an answer.
I sort of see that side of it. He gave all of himself to this endeavor. And at some point, I mean, that must be mentally exhausting.
There are people who talk about, like, he would cry inside of the exercise classes. Like, this was a guy who, you know, you've seen him. It's absolute, boundless, vibrant joy, but maybe a really pained person behind all that. And I think what's interesting about this is Dan Taberski, actually, I should have mentioned this. He was a friend. I mean, he'd go to the exercise class. He and his husband had been to Richard Simmons' house several times. But it's a kind of about, like, that whole public-private thing. Like, you know, if you're a public personality, can you choose to suddenly be private without setting off alarm bells? You know, if you're a friend, do you owe anything to other people? I don't know. I think it's really interesting. Yeah.
Do you think you would owe listeners if you suddenly disappeared, Virginia?
I don't know if anyone would miss
me. Oh, come on.
No, do I think I owe? Geez.
Or maybe do you think people would think that you owe them?
Maybe that's it. But I think I do have, it's so odd. You know, Peter, you're in the air too. You have a relationship with your listeners, even if you're not talking to them. Mm-hmm. And it's not just when you run into them. It's sort of like knowing that they are there, you know, knowing that there is this community of people that you are part of is very powerful. But I've never thought about that as a kind of responsibility to them to perform.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. But I also, you know, don't run outside every time someone with a bumper sticker with NHPR goes by and says, hi.
You know what I mean? You're welcome.
Are you a member?
How old is that bumper sticker anyway? Wow. I would say it's pretty fascinating. It's Missing Richard Simmons. 2 episodes in. They're going to be on their 3rd. I don't know when. I don't know when they drop it. So it's not a sort of binge listening thing yet. But, you know, 2 episodes in, it's pretty interesting and asks some interesting questions.
I think we should have Peter release the full 12 minutes of his cricket audio so everyone can escape with you.
I would be happy to.
Perfect.
Just chill out. And it's much cheaper than a cabin in Yarmouth.
Certainly. That's the service we provide.
That is Overheard for today. Peter Biello, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Logan Shannon, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Links to all of our audio choices are going to be online at wordofmouthradio.org. I guess Peter's will be too.
Yeah, we'll put it up there.
Want to let you know what is landing in New Hampshire this week, a sure harbinger of spring. The Poetry Out Loud state finals jump off at the New Hampshire State House this Friday. That's March the 10th. I'm thrilled to say that I will be hosting the event, which I find by far one of the most energizing, heartening events of the year.
Hannah Burke.
Frenson Pakbahan.
Eden Suoth.
Hannah, Frenson, and Eden were finalists from 2014, each of them carrying on in the tradition of memorizing and reciting, or performing, poetry, a ritual that has been with us since the dawn of civilization.
Sanctuary by Jean Valentine. People pray to each other, the way I say you to someone else, respectfully, intimately.
My poem is titled The Gift by Lee Young Lee. To pull the metal splinter from my palm, my father recited a story in a low voice. I watched his
Vigil Strange I Kept on the Field One Night by Walt Whitman. Vigil strange I kept on the field one night, when you, my son, and my comrade dropped at my side that day. One look I but gave, which your dear eyes returned.
Somehow there in the grand chamber of the State House, a place where there's so much debate and chest thumping and holding up issues that divide us, the distilled language and provocative ideas and the way poems slow us down to think about truths feels somehow restorative. It may be hard to imagine if you haven't read a poem since high school, so come and see for yourself as students from high schools all across New Hampshire pour their passions and channel their well-honed sense of drama into poems. That's this Friday at the State House, and it's free. There's more information at wordofmouthradio.org. That's it for today. Music in this episode came to us from Uncanny Valley's Jazar Blue Dot Sessions and Poddington Bear. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.